We're talking about Jacob's appropriation of the birthright. And I thought that we would begin by letting you know how the Bible itself evaluates Jacob's taking the birthright. Because we talked a lot about whether it is, in fact, stealing or whether he deserved it. And you could obviously make a case either way. The case that he deserved it is based on the fact that he negotiated it earlier with Esau, right? When Esau was in the field, he said, give me some of that stuff to eat. And Jacob said, sure, give me the birthright. And also the fact that it seems afterwards that Jacob is the right choice and that God tells Rebekah when they're in their womb that the older will serve the younger. And yet, despite all of that, it's still true that Jacob has to deceive his old blind father in order to get it. And presumably, if it were so clear that he deserved it, he wouldn't have to do that. And later commentators, as the class last week, are divided on how to evaluate Jacob's conduct. And I talked about the fact that the rabbis generally try to defend Jacob's conduct. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through a bit of the story again, and then at the end we'll take questions and comments. So I want to read you two quotations from the prophets that evaluate Jacob. I read them last year, but it's always good to renew our acquaintance with Jeremiah and Hosea. This is what Jeremiah says. Beware every man of his friend. Those of you who are interested, this is Jeremiah 9:3. So if you have a Tanakh and you want to look it up, Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 3. I can't tell you what page it's on, obviously, because we all have different editions. But every man should be aware of his, should beware every man of his friend. Trust not even a brother. Okay? For every brother takes advantage, and every friend is base in his dealings. Now, how do we know that this is about Jacob? Because the Hebrew for every man is base. Base means not straightforward, not legitimate in his dealings. Let me read you the Hebrew. What's Jacob's Hebrew name? Yaakov. Ki kol ach, every brother, akov Yaakov. So Jeremiah is clearly letting you know that he's not crazy about what Jacob did. Everyone is, you know, that's what brothers do. And Jacob is the paradigm for this. Let me read you now from Hosea, another prophet. The Lord once indicted Judah and punished Jacob for his conduct. There it's explicit. Now, the only conduct that we're aware of that you could punish Jacob for is either the stealing of the birthright or perhaps favoring Joseph, but it doesn't seem that favoring Joseph is the issue here. So it says, requited him for his deeds. Kama'alalav yashivlo. And it does, giving him the tunic doesn't seem to be the deed. The Torah nowhere else condemns it. But obviously, stealing the birthright from his brother is something that could be condemned. So for both of these, there is at least in the Bible, there is some warrant for the idea that what Jacob did is wrong. Now, what I want to do is also, by the way, Sarna has a nice observation here. Nachum Sarna, who did the commentary for the JPS series, he points out, where is it? The Bible says of Abraham that he died at a good, ripe age, old and contented. Isaac is similarly described as dying in ripe old age, but such notice is singularly and revealingly lacking in the case of Jacob. This patriarch can only report that the years of his life have been few and bitter. So why is it that Jacob doesn't get to have the good old age that Abraham and Isaac do? The only reason that immediately springs to mind is that he must have done something wrong. And again, if you're looking in Jacob's life for something wrong, you don't have to look very far. The stealing of the birthright is the obvious place. But my researches did not end there. Let me first talk to you about, first I want to talk to you about altars commentary. This is among the, when I bring books in, I just like to show them to you. I'm not telling you you should buy all of these, but you should at least know that they exist. Robert Alter, who is a literary scholar up at UC Berkeley, has written many books on literature and a few books on the Bible, including a, if you can call a book on the biblical literature famous, then this book is famous, okay? But that means, you know, the people who study biblical literature all know it. It's called The Art of Biblical Narrative, in which he shows how carefully written as stories the Bible is. So this is his biblical, he published a biblical commentary about, I don't know, 2 years ago or so, as he also published, and when we, maybe when we finish the Torah, we'll go to the story of David, he published the story of David. But I want to read you some of Alter's commentary on the story of Jacob and Esau, because he has some interesting things to say. First of all, he says, you have to be careful about finding numbers in the Torah, right? Because this is an endless task and people love to find numbers in the Torah. But, he says, within the limits of convention, the writer has woven an artful chain. The story, which is mostly dialogue, is seven interlocking scenes. First there's Isaac Esau, then Rebecca Jacob, then Jacob Isaac, then Isaac Esau, then Rebecca Jacob, then Rebecca Isaac, then Isaac Jacob. The first two pair set out the father and his favorite son, the mother and her favorite son, in opposite tracks. Husband and wife are kept apart until the penultimate, that means the before last, right? Penultimate is the one before the last, penultimate scene, and there is no dialogue at all between the two brothers or between Rebecca and Esau. It is surely not accidental that there are just seven scenes and that the word bracha, blessing, is repeated seven times. And then when we asked, I'll tell you Alter's explanation, why does Rebecca say that Isaac told Jacob he was going to bless him, Isaac told Esau that he was going to bless him in God's presence, but he didn't actually say that, right? Isaac says to Esau, I'm going to bless you with my soul's innermost blessing. Then Rebecca turns around and says to Jacob, your father said to your brother, I'm going to bless you with God's blessing. And we asked why. Alter's explanation is that Rebecca, and this was actually mentioned by someone last week, Rebecca wants Jacob to know that this is the blessing that his brother's about to get. So there isn't any time to waste. This is God's blessing, and God's blessing is irrevocable. And Alter says that, and every source I consulted said the same thing, which is once Isaac gives the blessing, whether he gives it mistakenly, whether he gives it to the person he didn't think he was giving it to, whether he gives it reluctantly, it's done, right? A blessing once given is irrevocable as words once spoken are irrevocable. Okay, so then he tells, remember, he says to Esau, go out and hunt. And then what does Rebecca say to Isaac? Go out and do what? Yeah, get me some sheep. Two kids, right? A little chad gadya in there. Two kids. Kids, that is, baby sheep, will again be an instrument of deception turned on Jacob when his sons bring Jacob's tunic soaked in kids' blood. Remember later on when they bring Jacob the coat and they say Jacob is dead? It's soaked in the blood of a kid, which is reminiscent of the deception here, which may again be a subtle way of the Torah's condemning Jacob without, it's very rare. And in fact, I'll give you an example later. I'll talk about it in a second. It's very rare for the Torah to say, and what this person did was bad. The Torah will describe it, sometimes hint at it, but primarily allows us to draw the conclusions about it. So if you know that Jacob is deceived the same way he deceived someone else, that probably lets you know he shouldn't have done it. Judah, the engineer of this deception. Judah is the one who makes sure that his father is deceived. Okay, are you with me still? I'm now picking up the narrative thread again. Later on, Jacob is going to be deceived that Joseph is dead. Judah is the son who's going to deceive him. Judah, the engineer of this deception, will promise to send kids as payment to the woman that he imagines is a prostitute. But who is that woman really? Tamar, his daughter-in-law, whom he has wronged. So Judah, too, will be involved in a deception that has kids as part of it. So there is this sort of interlocking chain. This is what Alter is so good at. This is what I mean when I say he analyzes the Bible from a literary point of view. There is this interlocking chain of deception involving the same means of deception, which lets you know that the Bible is making a comment on the fact that Jacob does this. And notice that when he says, when Rebekah says, do this, fool your father, get the birthright, what would you expect Jacob to say? He says, I'm going to get caught. What he does not say is, but that's wrong, right? So we are compiling now a picture of Jacob that's different from the Jacob that we will find later. In fact, that's in part the subject of this Shabbos morning sermon, but is what the whole business with the struggle with the angel is about. Because I'll give you the question of the sermon, but not the answer. Jacob says to the, what does Jacob say to the angel? I won't let you go until you bless me. Does the angel bless him? What does the angel say to him? He says, your name isn't Jacob anymore, now it's Israel. But he doesn't bless him. He doesn't promise him prosperity or wisdom or children or anything. He says, I won't let you go till you bless me. He changes his name and he lets him go. Why is that? That's for Shabbos. Okay. But he doesn't say here, that's a bad thing to do and I shouldn't do that. Instead, he just says, I'm going to get caught. And even when Rebecca says, the sin is on me, introducing the idea that there is a sin, right? He still doesn't say, oh no, Mom, if there's a sin, it's on me. I'm the one who's doing it. I'm the one who's benefiting. What can I tell you? Anyway, so, and then this is, and Alter makes this point. I want you to take a look at your translation. Alter's translation is much better, and I didn't notice it last time, but he points it out. We're now on chapter 27 of Genesis. Where is it? Okay, right. Verse 18. It says, and he went to his father and said, Father. And he said, yes, which of my sons are you? Okay? But Alter points out very properly that that's not really, not only is that not the accurate translation, but it robs the verse of its poignancy. What he says is, mi ata bini, who are you, my son? Which is a very different question from which of my sons are you, right? Who are you, my son? If you want to take all the drama and meaning out of it, so you translate it, which of my sons are you? But if you want to leave in the ambiguity and the possibility that maybe he knows what's going on and he's asking him, who are you really, right? Then you leave it the way it is, which is, who are you, my son? And that's how Alter translates it. Much more powerful, I think. And it lets you know again how much you depend on the translator to determine your reading of the text. Now, let's see. Oh, when he says in verse 19, apparently, the first time that the word Bechor is used, what does Bechor mean? Right. Bechor is the firstborn. As opposed to Gadol, which is the bigger son or the elder son. The Bechor, the idea of the Bechor is the one that gets the blessing, right? Apparently, and you can look through the story to verify this, Esav is never called the Bechor. He's called the first one who came out of the womb. He's called the elder, but he's never called the Bechor. The first one to introduce the word Bechor is Jacob himself, right? he's the first one to use the word Bechor. So that then, because the narrator knows that in some deep sense Esau is not the Bechor, right? And I have a friend who is actually writing a book about twins. She told me that in almost every culture that she studied, which is tribal cultures as well as modern cultures, and this is interesting, the second one born is considered the first one conceived. Because the first one in is the second one out, right? Makes sense. And so she says, even in tribal cultures, they consider that the younger one is the first one conceived, and in that sense is also the older one. I don't remember a rabbinic defense of Jacob in that way, but I suppose that you could. And actually, it doesn't really work in the Jewish tradition, because in the Jewish tradition, everything depends on birth. So for example, if you have a surrogate in Judaism, the surrogate is considered the mother of the child, and the child has to be adopted by the natural mother, even though it's her egg, because the birth mother is considered the mother, right? Judaism didn't know from surrogacy, and whoever gives birth to the kid is considered the kid's mother. So that if you have a surrogate in Judaism, you have to have the child sometimes converted if the surrogate is not Jewish, or adopted, whatever. In other words, there's a procedure there, even though the child is genetically Jewish, by birth mother isn't, and so you have to do that, which, by the way, is a very easy thing to do with a child, especially a conversion. Not a big deal. They don't have to study or anything. So that I thought was an interesting point. And then there were one or two other things that Alter teaches us. Yes, this is great too. In verse 23. The same verb, and again, this is characteristic of Alter's reading. It says, in verse 23, it says, Velo hikiru, he did not recognize him. That same word, haker, is used when he is deceived by his brothers about Joseph, right? He recognized the coat, haker, and the same thing is used in the Judah story, right? With the Judah and Tamar story that we mentioned before. So the same word is used that ties all three stories together. And also, I don't think I realized quite the level of, until Alter, in the name of a German Bible scholar named von Rad, pointed it out, don't think I realized sort of the level of how careful a deception this was. And I think if a movie director would probably pick this up cinematically. But think about this for a minute. Jacob is going to come in and say, I'm Esau, here's your meal. Okay? Rebecca anticipates that Isaac will feel him and smell him. That's why she puts all this animal skin on him and animal hair. Now realize the level of deceptive planning that is required for her to assume that Isaac may mistrust it, and these are the means by which her old blind husband will check to see if Jacob is really Jacob. So not only does she prepare him to deceive, but she anticipates Isaac's reaction to the deception and makes provision for that too, to make sure that the deception is complete. I never thought about it, but she really has to think, why does she put hair all over him and animal skin on him? She wants him to smell like Esau, right? But that assumes that Isaac is going to work by smell, and he probably isn't going to do that if Esau comes in and he sounds like Esau. He's not going to say, come over here, I want to feel you and smell you, right? So there's a very sort of cold, calculating aspect to this, because Rebecca knows her husband. She knows how he works and what he'll do, right? So, and she wants to make sure that this is all successful. And then, verse 32. When he says to Jacob, who are you? He adds, my son. When he says to Esau, who are you? He doesn't say, my son. Now, there are two ways to read this. The ungenerous way of reading this is he's repudiating Esau as his son. But I don't think that that's really what's going on. I think what's going on is what Alter is saying. He can't, the only possible explanation for this being Esau is Jacob just deceived him. And he doesn't want to admit that to himself. So he can't believe this is Esau. And instead of saying, "Who are you, my son?" he says, "Who are you?" Because he can't imagine this is Esau. Because if this is Esau, who was that guy who just fooled him? It could only be Jacob, and Isaac doesn't want to admit that to himself. So he just says, "Who are you?" And that it's when Esau said, "I am Esau, your firstborn," that he, that the whole thing unravels, and then he realizes that he has blessed the wrong or the right person, depending on. And here's another. This actually deepens the characterization of Rebekah. We're almost at the end of Alter's analysis, but this is great. Look at verse 41. "Now Esau harbored a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing which his father had given him. And Esau said to himself, 'Let the mourning period of my father come, and I'll kill my brother Jacob.' When the words of her older son were reported to Rebekah, she sent for her younger son and said to him, 'Your brother Esau is consoling himself by planning to kill you.'" Now, what doesn't work? What doesn't track about that? To whom did Esau say it?
Himself.
So how does he get reported to Rebekah? Maybe. All sorts of possibilities. I'll read you Alter's possibilities. Since he noticed it, let me... "He had spoken these words in what is presented as an interior monologue, but one must infer that Esau was unable to restrain himself and keep counsel with his own heart, but instead blurted his murderous intention to people in the household." Maybe that would be consistent with what we know about Esau, right? Esau is not a disciplined character. He's a wild man. And so you can imagine him storming around the house saying, "I'm going to kill that guy," right? "I'm going to kill him." Even if he's saying it to himself, he's dead, right? Haven't you heard people, overheard people say such things? Go back for a second. And where is it? Verse 8. Okay. Verse 8. "Now, my son, listen carefully as I instruct you. V'ata b'ni shma b'koli." Right? She doesn't actually say, "Listen carefully." She says, "Listen to my voice." Okay? Go now at the end of the episode, verse 43. "V'ata b'ni shma b'koli." The exact same words, right? Rebekah has opened the episode with her voice, and now she closes it with her voice. Jacob has tried to deceive Isaac with his voice, although not successfully. He doesn't deceive him with his voice, remember, but with the rest of him. That's why Isaac says the voice is the voice of Jacob. And now he has to run away because of that deception. So really, I think that the brackets are intended to emphasize to us that Rebekah is, as Maurice Samuel wrote in his essay about her, is the manager. Right? Rebekah starts it with her counsel to Jacob, and she ends it with her counsel to Jacob. Now that he's stolen the birthright, he has to run away. Now let's talk for a second about the blessings. Because I want to try to wrap this chapter up so that we can get started with the story of Jacob himself. Look at the blessing, verse 28. "May God give you the dew of the heaven, the fat of the earth, abundance of new grain and wine. Let people serve you, nations bow down to you, be master over your brothers, and your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be they who curse you, blessed be they who bless you." Okay? That's the blessing. Then notice what he gives Esau at the bottom of the page. Fat of the earth, well, at the bottom of the page, verse 39. "The fat of the earth, the dew of the heaven, yet by your sword you shall live," right? And you'll break the yoke of his. Okay, you got that? The format of these blessings, when God speaks, for example, to Abraham, contains two things. First, there's the land. "I'll assign this land to your offspring." Now, not to Jacob, but to Abraham. and the covenant. I'll make your offspring as the dust of the earth, right? That's how God speaks to Abraham. Sometimes it also includes a covenant with God, right? As we see in the narrative of Abraham's circumcision, it's a covenant with God. None of these elements is mentioned in the words of that Isaac blesses Jacob. None of them. Not the land, not your offspring, not God. So here's an alternate theory. The blessing that Isaac was going to give Esau was not the blessing of being the head of the Jewish people. He doesn't give him that blessing. He was always going to give that to Jacob, which is why he doesn't mention God, he doesn't mention the land, and he doesn't mention offspring.
Because he thinks he's talking to
Esau, and Esau doesn't get that blessing. Jacob gets that blessing, which is an amazing possibility given to us by whoever wrote this. It's Professor Sherlow at Bar-Ilan. And I don't know if this is his, chidush, but it's a beautiful idea. The blessing only spoke of the dew of the heaven, the fat of the earth, of abundance, of relationship with other nations, of being master over his brothers, but the land and progeny weren't mentioned at all. The blessing of the patriarchs was passed on to Jacob for the first time at the end of this week's reading, that is chapter 28, verse 3 and 4. When Jacob is running away and Isaac is saying goodbye to Jacob, look at verse 3, may El Shaddai bless you, okay? May he make you fertile and numerous so you become an assembly of peoples. May he grant you the blessing of Abraham. He doesn't say that when he thinks he's Esau. He only said, and now he knows it's Jacob running away, and he knows that Jacob has fooled him, but he also knows that Jacob is the one who gets this blessing, which puts a whole different light on the possibility of this story and what's going on. That Isaac was in fact deceived. He gave Jacob a blessing that was intended for Esau, but the real blessing of being the head of the Jewish people was never intended for Esau because Isaac knew better. So if that's true, and it's just one of many ways of reading the story, that really puts a quite different spin on the actions of everyone involved, and especially Isaac. That is, yes, Isaac was fooled, but the ikar, the essence of it, he always knew, and he always intended to do the way that God wanted him to. Let's see. Okay. I want to make an announcement or two and take some questions. Although Jonathan Sachs, I think it's Sachs, has a nice, there's one other point, is that, now I forgot what I was going to say. I remember several years ago reading an essay by Rabinovitch, who was a philosopher of Judaism, who actually David Myers at UCLA has just completed a book about him that hasn't been published yet. And he talks about the fact that Maimonides notices that there is this strategy of what's called orma elohit, which means divine transgression. In other words, doing something that is, he calls it an altruistic transgression, that is doing something that is bad in order to attain something that is good, okay? This has a long history in the Jewish tradition. It turned out badly because this was what Shabtai Tzvi, who was the false messiah, talked about, that is mitzvah haba'a me'avera, the mitzvah that comes through a sin, right? But that's one explanation, a Kabbalistic explanation of what Jacob is doing here, right? He's creating a mitzvah through a sin. So if you want to exonerate Jacob, and I'm not sure that you do, but if you want to, you can take that. All right, I'm going to leave. Yeah, I have a couple of other comments, but I'm going to leave them for the moment, and just stop there and take questions or comments about anything that we have done so far. Yeah.
It seems to me that I've struggled this since I began reading Torah a few years ago. If you take the story of Ishmael and his being sent out into the desert, and you combine it with the story of Esau losing the birthright, it seems to me that the author is telling us to read this story understanding there is deliberate ambiguity and deliberate ambivalence, and be careful of what you read.
Okay.
It's
all right.
Up front, we're told, don't take it.
Okay.
Don't take it. You're allowed to dig into it. You can question the storyteller.
Two-point question. First, I think Esau never got any credit for saying that, let my father die and the mourning period is over, then I'll kill my brother.
Right.
So he, even in his anger, he thought about his
yes.
father.
He does. He does get credit for that. And I'll mention the way he gets credit for that, by the way, is when they come back and bury Isaac. Do you know what it says? That Esau and Jacob buried their father. Esau comes first. In other words, he gets his priority in birth restored when he comes back to bury his father because he observed the mitzvah of kibud av. So kibud av is honoring your father. That's a good question. What did Jacob do to be a righteous person? You can't say he raised nice kids. Okay, so there are two answers to that. One is an answer that the Torah gives us, and one is one that we have to infer. The wrestling with the angel, the fact that he reconciles with Esau and is honest, apparently, with Laban, and that's that part. But the reason I think that the Torah considers Jacob righteous ultimately is because he continued the tradition in a hostile world, right? He managed to transmit the Jewish tradition sufficiently well that when they went down to Egypt, they were recognized as different and as Jews. So, and he left behind him this legacy of, you know, which is why, you know, that this is the Midrashic comment. I don't know, those of you who were here last night and heard Esther Jungreich, she mentioned this and said that it was in the Torah, but she was using the Torah loosely here. It's really the rabbis that the Shema is addressed to Jacob, right? Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. That's what the children are saying to Jacob. Listen, Israel, even though you're dying, we want you to know we still follow the God of Israel. And that's considered Jacob's great virtue, is that he succeeded in leaving behind him a people. I mean, after all, when he was born, what Isaac left behind was a person. He just left Jacob. When Jacob died, he left behind a people. So that transformation happened, you know, and that's why he left behind him. The names of the tribes were all Jacob's children. So, yeah.
Is there any clue that Jacob ever found out what Rebecca was up to, that she was doing this behind the scene? Because later he says, go to your mother's uncle.
Right.
Find a bride. Like, he's like clueless.
Yeah, no, there is none, is the short answer. And whether Isaac would have resented it is a conclusion. I mean, most people you would assume would resent it, but we'd need to know much more about the dynamic between the two of them, which we don't know at all, if we were going to be sure that he resented it. This is, by the way, the very end of the chapter, which we didn't talk about. But let's look at verse 43 and let's read the end just so we're up to date. And actually chapter 28 so that we can get started next time on Jacob. Now my son, listen to me. Flee at once to Haran to my brother Lavan. Stay with him a while until your brother's fury subsides. Stay with my brother till you reconcile with your brother, right? Rebecca, of course, has run away from her brother too. Until your brother's anger against you subsides and he forgets what you have done to him. Which is very unlikely. Then I will fetch you from there. Let me not lose you both in one day. That lets you know, by the way, that Esau knew that Rebekah did this. That's how she lost Esau, because he knows, and you can imagine if he's going to kill his brother, he may not kill his mother, but he's not going to speak to her. Rebekah said to Isaac, I'm disgusted with my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries a Hittite woman like these from among the native women, what good will life be to me? Now, I just actually had a revelation, a completely different way of reading this verse. I'm going to reconfigure this a little bit. This is what a psychiatrist once told me about traditional societies, okay? He said, in traditional societies, the relationship between mother and son tends to be very, very close. And the reason that that's true is that women have no power. Only men have power. And therefore, if a woman wants to have power, she has to be close to her son. And that's why, when that son gets married, if the woman he marries does not submit to the mother, she's lost all her power. And therefore, there's an inbuilt hostility between the mother and the daughter-in-law, who's taking away her power base in the family, since he's taking away her son. Okay? I'm not applying this to anyone. I'm just telling you that this is what he said. And it doesn't matter who the psychiatrist was. But I just read this verse differently. Rebekah has just lost her power base. She lives, after all, in a traditional family, and she's a powerful woman. And what's the first thing she complains about when Jacob is gone? Esau's wives, because they're Hittite women, so they probably don't submit to her. Why should they? So now she's stuck, because she doesn't have Jacob anymore, and she certainly doesn't have Esau, and she doesn't have Esau's wives. She's left without any power, and this is a powerful woman. So the first thing she wants to do is to get Esau married to more congenial people so that she can have some influence over his wives, since she doesn't have any influence over Jacob anymore. So Isaac sent for Jacob and blessed him. He instructed him, saying, you can discuss the theory later. He instructed him, saying, you shall not take a wife from among the Canaanite women. Go to Padan Aram, the house of Betuel, your mother's father, and take a wife from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother, because Rebekah will have some influence over, right? If Jacob marries people that she's related to, they'll still listen to her because she'll be the matriarch of the family instead of these Hittite women who could care less about Rebekah. May El Shaddai bless you, make you fertile and numerous, so you become an assembly of peoples. May he grant the blessing of Abraham to you and your offspring, that you may possess the land where you are sojourning, which God assigned to Abraham. Then Isaac sent Jacob off, and he went to Padan Aram, to Laban, the son of Betuel, the Aramean, brother of Rebekah, mother of Jacob and Esau. And let's just finish up again. We're talking about how Esau gets no credit, but he's all right here. When Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him to Padan Aram to take a wife from there, charging him as he blessed him, you shall not take a wife from among the Canaanite women, and that Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and gone to Padan Aram, Esau realized that the Canaanite women displeased his father Isaac. I guess he always knew that they displeased his mother, but he didn't know they displeased his father. Now he's upset. So Jacob went to Ishmael and took a wife. Esau went to Ishmael and took a wife, in addition to the wives he had, Mahalat, daughter of Ishmael, son of Abraham, sister of Nebaut. Now, he's marrying in the family, right? Granted, it's not the branch of the family that, you know, is going to carry the covenant, but still, he's marrying in the family, because Esau also wants to be loved, which is why he cries this bitter cry when he's lost his blessing, right? He has the same impulses as everyone else, yeah.
I think Rebecca even guilted him into that, because she says, before he finds out what you have done.
Yeah, right, exactly, says to Isaac, because Isaac did it, even though she tricked him, he after all did it. Just like, you know, you say when you're upset with your children, look what your children have done, right? These children that you, right. So that completes the Isaac cycle, so to speak, which is much shorter, by the way, than the Abrahamic cycle, than the Jacob cycle. Let me talk about next week's class. Unfortunately, there won't be one. I'm sorry about that, but it's kibbud av. My father is not well, and I have to go to Philadelphia to visit. So I'm going to New York, and I'm doing the Today Show, by the way, on Tuesday morning. So those of you who will be home, They said they think after 9:30, sometime in the 9:30, 10 hour, and then I'm going to go to Philadelphia for a couple days. Which means that we resume in January, January 8th after the new year, and then we start with the story of Jacob, and God willing, we will have uninterrupted time to study. But for that, any questions or comments on anything we've... Yes, Don.
Mistakes by scriveners who don't quite get the words right in just doing.
Oh, well, this is a gigantic field. And I'll give you two examples, okay? It's not only scribal mistakes, repeating words, changing words, so on. It's also what's called in the Jewish tradition kri and ketiv, that which you read and that which is written. In other words, what you understand the words to mean as opposed to what, and I'll give you the most famous example. But first, in terms of translation, the most famous example of a mistranslation is Michelangelo's Statue of Moses, right, which has horns on it. Because keren, which in Hebrew can mean horn, also means ray of light. But the Latin translation, the Vulgate, took it as meaning horn instead of ray of light, so it said that Moses came down from the mountain with horns instead of with rays of light, which is why, even to this day, there are people who believe that Jews have horns, right? And the most famous Kri Ketiv is a really amazing one. It's a very famous verse, and people are not aware that there is this difference. But in the book of Job, the translation is, though he slay me, I will believe in him or trust him, which is the quintessence of what Job said, right? This is Job's great statement of faith. It does, even if God kills me, I'll still believe. And Job is the book in the Bible that's all about your faith being tested and having faith through tests, okay? The Hebrew is that even if he kills me, lo ayachel, in him, lamed aleph, in him I will believe. But lamed aleph, meaning in him, is not what's written. What's written is lamed vav, I'm sorry, lamed aleph is written, which means lo ayachel, I will not believe in him. So what the book says is, if you read it according to the way it's written, if he slays me, I will no longer believe in him. But the way the rabbis say we're supposed to read it is, if he slays me, in him will I believe. Now, what the author meant, who knows? Job is by far, and everyone will tell you this, Job is the hardest book of the Bible to translate. There's arguments about almost every word, because it's all ancient poetry, it's very old poetry, and it's also philosophical poetry and imagery, so we don't know exactly which animals they're referring to, how they acted, what they meant. And a very, very, very good, by the way, modern translation, one of the most highly praised of all the modern, and there are lots of them, was done by Ray Shinlin, Larry Shinlin's brother, right, who is a scholar of medieval Hebrew poetry at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And his little book on Job with the translation and commentary is an excellent, excellent, wonderful book. Remember that the Torah was copied over and over and over and over and over again. And here's something that I will tell you. I remember during the whole controversy about the question about whether the Bible was to be taken literally true, that several rabbis told people to ask me, if in fact the Bible is not literally the Word of God, then why is it that every manuscript of the Bible that we have from ancient times is exactly identical? And what I said to the people who asked me was, you actually could not express the opposite of the truth with more concision. There are no two old manuscripts of the Torah that exist in the world that are the same. All of them have differences. In fact, when we went to rabbinical school, we received this thick book called the BHS, better known as the, or not, if not known at all, as the Biblical Hebraica Stuttgart, which is a comparison of all the oldest, by the way, manuscript of the Torah goes back to the 10th century. So it's still new, relatively, except for the Dead Sea Scrolls, which also have differences in them from the Torah that we know. And the Septuagint, the Greek version, has differences from the Torah that we know. And the Targum, the ancient Aramaic translations, have differences from the Torah that we know. And you would expect that because people copied them. And if you've ever tried to copy something, especially something as long as this, you know that it is impossible for human beings to do that perfectly. They can do it close, and they would compare it with old manuscripts and proofread and so on. But, you know, someone handed me, for Mount Sinai Memorial Parks, they handed me the new, we're trying to put a new book of mourning together because the old one is old and the translations are poor and the layout is poor and so on. And I said to him, has this been proofread? He said, numerous times. So Cantor Brown and I sat at the board meeting, not that we weren't listening, and proofread it, and we found 30, 40 mistakes. And you just think it's very hard to get things right, even with computers and spell checks and all of it. It's just very hard. Yeah.
When you were talking about Rebecca through the power and how powerless she would be, I was just resonating about affiliation, that she, and this is a commentary that I don't think is made that much, but it seems to me that even at the beginning with the struggling of having twins, it's one thing to go to a different land and then, but when you're giving birth, to not be surrounded by people that you're familiar with, that would have
been very hard. Although she was very eager to leave the people that she, but she doesn't have, but still.
Yeah.
They're all immigrants. It's true.
And so it may be that it wasn't just that she was struggling for her power base, but also because she was struggling for daughter-in-laws or people that she could.
That she could be close to, right. Yes, it's certainly true that if you start a new tradition, that you're going to be very lonely because there aren't other people around like you. Yeah.
Are we going to have class in 2 weeks, which happens to be Christmas?
No. No, we don't. We start again January 8th.